may it please the court. Good morning, honorable judges. My name is Godfrey Mwangi for the petitioner, Muhammad Juma. Mr. Juma came to the United States, spent about a week in New York, and was then admitted to Canada, where he sought refugee status. And his application for refugee status was reviewed by the Refugee Board of Canada for about a year, denied, and the Canadian authorities then returned him to the United States, where he sought asylum. And his application was reviewed and ultimately denied by the immigration judge, who found that Mr. Juma lacked credibility, based in part on the decision of the presiding member of the Refugee Board of Canada. What appears to have troubled the immigration judge in the United States are findings by the presiding member of the Canadian Refugee Board, which we on appeal have problems with, because the record before the IJ in the United States does not contain what the presiding member of the Canadian Refugee Board relied upon to make her conclusions.
And I agree with you that that's a real problem for the IJ. And I guess one of the things I'd like you to address is the whole question of whether or not the mistreatment was severe enough to amount to past prosecution, because we had a one-time incident here. I mean, I think that's the biggest hurdle you face.
I believe, Judge Williams, that he does, because this court has held that a single incident can amount to persecution if it is severe enough and if the mistreatment is on account of one of the protected bases under the statute. Clearly, Mr. Juma was targeted because of his relationship to his uncle, Mr. Garfa, a former minister in the Chadian government, who was sought because he had disagreed with the president of Chad, and the government sought him because he was thought to be preparing to overthrow the government. And so in the search for Garfa, relatives and others who were thought to be Garfa's supporters were arrested in order to flush out Mr. Garfa. And so Juma was held for several days and whipped repeatedly because he kept saying he did not know where his uncle was. That act of being punished because he kept denying knowledge of his uncle's whereabouts is punishment, because he did not admit what the persecutors were trying to get from him. But it is also punishment because it offended them, because he is connected to the object of their anger, namely his uncle. I believe it amounts to persecution because there is no legitimate purpose for it. The IJ argues...
Is it persecution on grounds of what? Religion, ethnicity, political beliefs, or what?
I believe, Your Honor, it can be an imputed political opinion, but it could also be membership in a particular social group. A family is a social group.
Well, but that would turn that, then everything. But the statute, you know, limits persecution. It has to be persecution on the basis of religion, race, politics, what have you. If you define a family as a group that can be persecuted, then any kind of disagreement, hostility, anger, so on, can be turned into persecution, can it?
I will concede that that would make it a bit too broad. In this case, however, Judge Posner, they were seeking GARFA specifically because GARFA disagreed with the Chadian president's policies. They were seeking him supposedly because he sought to overthrow the government, and the people who were arrested were not merely people who were randomly selected. They were selected because of connections to him, either familial or because they supported him or were perceived as his supporters. This targeting of family members continued even beyond just the September 14, 1994 departure of GARFA. It continued into Cameroon. People of the Tama tribe were perceived as supporters of GARFA and therefore thought to support his so-called insurgency against the government of Chad. Now, in the incident in which Juma, his cousin Mokhtar, and the other members of the family were arrested, only specific members of the family, namely the males, were arrested. Females were left alone. And in these communities and these societies, the male members are the ones who are thought to be active in politics and are usually the ones who are targeted. They were beaten not because they were thought to have information about GARFA, because once you ask somebody to, you know, give you the information, you beat them once, twice, at some point you realize they don't have that information. But the repeated beating was really an act that these persecutors continued, despite the fact that their victims clearly didn't have that information. At some point, you recognize that this has gone beyond this effort to get information, and it becomes merely abusive and punishment for the sake of inflicting pain. And so at some point, you have to skip that threshold at which it is merely harassment and it becomes persecution. Now, as to at what point the family is a cognizable social group, well, at the point at which when you seek to punish the family because you cannot reach the person you're trying to reach, you should really then give the family the benefit of the protections the statute is intended to give, because the statute does not require proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the persecutor had a motive or an intent that was malignant or punitive. Asylum requires a reasonable possibility.
And then, and so what's the best case you have in terms of trying to make this connection to the family in these beatings to support, you know, the argument? What's the best case you have to support that argument?
Your Honor, in terms of a precedent or?
Yes, in terms of the family, if we, you say that there's some line that has to be drawn between just being a member of the family and something more, and you said this case crosses the line, that it's more than just that. Do you, you know, what's your best case to support that?
Because after they'd whipped them and they had gotten no information about GARFA, they didn't release them. In fact, Juma obtained his release by somebody he ran into who paid a bribe to obtain his release. For all we know, if he hadn't done that, he'd still be languishing in prison or dead.
Yeah, I was really asking about precedent. Any cases that you had that were similar, that you were, you know, the primary case you were relying on,
well,
in support of your argument.
There's a case out of Sudan that this court handed down. Niam, for example, is a case in which Niam was held and beaten and tortured to hand over or to give information about 11 others that were being sought that he was supposed to know about. In Niam's case, too, he gave a bribe, or somebody gave a bribe, so that he could escape imprisonment. And in that case, this court held that he was entitled to a review of his withholding claim. In that case, Niam had filed more than a year after his arrival, so his asylum claim had dissipated. But in that case, there was no clear indicator that this was a family relationship, but he was arrested in connection to others, and they wanted information from him about these 11 other people who were not found by the government, and he was being beaten to give up information about them. And so this is not exactly the same fact pattern, but it is similar. And so this family, I think, should be given protection by virtue of the fact that this punishment, if you want to describe it as prosecution, legitimate, that the government is entitled to conduct, at some point it becomes gratuitous because you've beaten them and they've given you no information. And if it's a legitimate prosecution, you ought to charge them with something or release them. If you don't release them and just continue to beat them up, at some point you have to recognize that as persecution.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mwangi. Mr. Vondrak?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Frank Vondrak, and I represent the government in this matter. May it please the court. The immigration judge's decision was based on a finding that the petitioner's claim was not credible, and alternatively, that even if true, the petitioner failed to establish past persecution or a well-founded fear of future persecution. With the court's permission, I would like to address the second point first, that the petitioner had not established past persecution or a well-founded fear of future persecution. First of all, the petitioner claims that he was arrested on September 15, 2004, and held for 4 days. He was interrogated as to the whereabouts of his uncle, Mr. Garfa, and that Garfa was a former chief of staff of the Chadian Army and at the time was the Minister of Mines for the government of Chad. When Mr. Garfa fled the country, it's in the record that there's a possibility that he had embezzled funds from the Chadian government, and it's also in the record that Mr. Garfa was involved in plots to overthrow the government of Chad. The day after Mr. Garfa fled the country, the petitioner in this case was arrested, according to his testimony. He was held for the 4 days, and he was questioned as to the whereabouts of his uncle. He was beaten during those interrogations, according to his own testimony. Now, there's some discrepancy as to whether he was beaten with a whip or with a stick, but that's a distinction without difference as far as I personally would be concerned. However, it's interesting to note that his only claim of past persecution is this one instance where he was arrested by the government for the purpose of being interrogated as to the whereabouts of his uncle, who, as I said earlier, was involved in this plot against the Chadian government. A refugee is someone who is unable or unwilling to return to his native country because of a fear of persecution or because of past persecution or a well-founded fear of future persecution. And mere harassment is not sufficient to establish a claim of past persecution. This court has held that in Asani, and also in Dandan, this circuit has held that even 3 days without food and water is insufficient.
I thought your argument was different. I thought your argument was it wasn't persecution on political grounds because he was being held and abused in an investigation.
Well, that is true as well, Your Honor, and that is my primary point. But there's also the point that even if this court were to find that it was persecution on the basis of political or religious or family association, the degree and longevity of the torture to which the petitioner testified would still not rise to the level of persecution for purposes of the Immigration and Naturalization Act. Mr. Zuma also raised the claim of future persecution, and he based that on two points. The first was his relationship with his uncle, Mohammed Garfa, and the second was the fact that he was a member of the Tama tribe. Now, it's very important for this court to note that the first time, the very first time that the petitioner says that he or any member of his family was persecuted by the Chadian government was the day after Mohammed Garfa fled the country. And he's very clear in his testimony that the day after, very early in the morning, the presidential guard surrounded the house and five soldiers came in and took him and his cousin away. Now, he also testified, and quite candidly, that his mother, who has an even arguably closer family relationship to Mohammed Garfa, is still in the country, and his younger brother is still in the country. He also testified that he has another brother who had fled Chad, but he didn't know the reason for his other brother fleeing the country. Now, that's an important point, Your Honors, because of the fact that if his brother, I think that the petitioner on that point was being very candid. If his brother had fled the country because of fear of persecution, if his brother had fled the country because he had been beaten and tortured and all of that, that would have substantially supported the petitioner's claim. But as it stands,
so now he left Chad in 1994, 11 years ago. So is Garfa still hanging out in Benin or what?
I do not personally know, Your Honor, but the last indications in the record are that Mr. Garfa is still at large. It's also interesting to note that after fleeing the country, the petitioner went to Cameroon and spent 2 years there, and by his testimony, did not try to seek asylum there. He said,
does Cameroon have an asylum law?
Yes, according to the record, it does, Your Honor. And according to the record, it does have an asylum law. And however, the petitioner did testify that they did not, and that I believe the word he used was they are returned 100%. Yet nothing in the State Department report indicates that is the case. But it is interesting to note that he spent 2 years in another country, did not seek asylum. On his trip to Canada, he arrived first in the United States, and at that time did not seek asylum. And it was only once he went to Canada that he sought asylum.
Well, and aren't the Canadian laws a little more liberal? It's a little easier to get asylum. I mean, I recognize things have tightened up now, or they're tighter now, but it was easier at that time, wasn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe even at that point in time, mm-hmm. it was easier to establish a claim of persecution in Canada than it was in the United States. And certainly by this point, I'm very sure that it is even more difficult in the United States than it is in Canada.
So I'm just saying that that argument that he parked himself in Canada for 2 years and didn't try here in the U.S., given that our laws were tighter, is... I don't know if that's your best argument.
No, I agree with you, Your Honor. I'm just trying to be candid with you. But it's also true that if somebody is facing persecution, the application for asylum in the United States, I don't believe, would have precluded the petitioner from making a application for asylum in Canada. When you look at the facts altogether, As all of you are aware, this court is subject to the highly deferential substantial evidence standard, and findings of fact by the immigration judge are conclusive unless a reasonable adjudicator would be compelled to conclude to the contrary. And I know that that is a very difficult standard for this court to adhere to at all times, but that is the standard, and it is particularly applicable to this case.
Well, and of course, you recognize there's a problem with the IJ's determination with respect to the reason Canada rejected it when the IJ didn't have the record.
Well, that is very true, Your Honor, but at the immigration hearing before the immigration judge, the petitioner was represented by counsel, did have an opportunity to present his full case. In fact, did offer documentary evidence, did have another witness testify on his behalf. And the immigration judge did not find his testimony before her to be credible. In other words, she did not find his explanations of the inconsistencies that were pointed out in the Canadian authorities' decision to be credible either.
Thank you, Mr. Vondrash.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Mwangi, your time has expired, but you can have a minute if you have anything. Do you have anything? No further? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And we'll move on to the next argument where...